"Those are very interesting pieces of information," he said slowly.
"I thought you'd like them," said Robin, with a demure smile.
"Shines an interesting sidelight on Manny's assurance that he didn't push his boss down the stairs."
"They really didn't like you being there," said Robin, "but that might have been my fault.
I said you were a private detective, but Nanita, her English isn't as good as Manny's, didn't understand, so I said you were a kind of policeman, leading them to assume that Chard had invited me over to complain about Manny's violence towards him."
"Did Chard mention it?"
"Not a word," said Strike. "Much more concerned about Walder Graves' alleged treachery."
After visits to the bathroom, they returned to the cold, where they had to screw up their eyes against oncoming snow as they traversed the car park. A light frosting had already settled over the top of the Toyota.
"You're going to make it to King's Cross, right?" said Strike, checking his watch.
"Unless we hit trouble on the motorway," said Robin, surreptitiously touching the wood trim on the door's interior.
They had just reached the M4, where there were weather warnings on every sign, and where the speed limit had been reduced to 60, when Strike's mobile rang.
"Ilsa, what's going on?"
"Hi, Corm."
"Well, it could be worse. They haven't arrested her, but there was some intense questioning."
Strike turned the mobile onto speakerphone for Robin's benefit, and together they listened, similar frowns of concentration on their faces as the car moved through a vortex of swirling snow, rushing the windscreen.
"They definitely think it's her," said Ilsa.
"Based on what?"
"Opportunity," said Ilsa, "and her manner. She really doesn't help herself. Very grumpy at being questioned and kept talking about you, which put their backs up. She said you'll find out who really did it."
"Bloody hell," said Strike, exasperated.
"And what was in the lockup?"
"Oh yeah, that. It was a burned, blood-stained rag in among a pile of junk."
"Big effing deal," said Strike. "Could have been there for years."
"Forensics will find out, but I agree. It's not much to go on, seeing as they haven't even found the guts yet."
"You know about the guts?"
"Everyone knows about the guts now, Corm. It's been on the news."
Strike and Robin exchanged fleeting looks.
"When?"
"Lunchtime. I think the police knew it was about to break and brought her in to see if they could squeeze anything out of her before it all became common knowledge."
"It's one of their lot who leaked it," said Strike angrily.
"That's a big accusation."
"I had it from the journalist who was paying the copper to talk."
"Know some interesting people, don't you?"
"Comes with the territory."
"Thanks for letting me know, Ilsa."
"No problem. Try and keep her out of jail, Corm. I quite like her."
"Who is that?" Robin asked, as Ilsa hung up.
"Old school friend from Cornwall, lawyer. She's married to one of my London mates," said Strike. "I put Leonora onto her because..."
Shit.
They had rounded a bend to find a huge tailback ahead of them. Robin applied the brake and they drew up behind a Peugeot.
"Shit," repeated Strike, with a glance at Robin's set profile.
"Another accident," said Robin. "I can see flashing lights."
Her imagination showed her Matthew's face if she had to telephone him and say she was not coming, that she had missed the sleeper. His mother's funeral.
Who misses a funeral?
She should have been there already, at Matt's father's house, helping with arrangements, taking some of the strain. Her weekend bag ought already to have been sitting in her old bedroom at home, her funeral clothes pressed and hanging in her old wardrobe, everything ready for the short walk to the church the following morning. They were burying Mrs. Cunliffe, her future mother-in-law, but she had chosen to drive off into the snow with Strike, and now they were gridlocked, 200 miles from the church, where Matthew's mother would be laid to rest.
"He'll never forgive me. He'll never forgive me if I miss the funeral because I did this."
Why did she have to have been presented with such a choice, today of all days?
Why did the weather have to be so bad?
Robin's stomach churned with anxiety, and the traffic did not move.
Strike said nothing, but turned on the radio. The sound of Take That filled the car, singing about there being progress now, where once there was none. The music grated on Robin's nerves, but she said nothing. The line of traffic moved forward a few feet.
"Oh, please God, let me get to King's Cross on time,"
prayed Robin inside her head.
For 3/4 of an hour they crawled through the snow, the afternoon light fading fast around them. What had seemed a vast ocean of time until the departure of the night train was starting to feel to Robin like a rapidly draining pool in which she might shortly be sitting alone, marooned. Now they could see the crash ahead of them, the police, the lights, a mangled polo.
"You'll make it," said Strike,
speaking for the first time since he had turned on the radio as they waited their turn to be waved forwards by the traffic cop.
"It'll be tight, but you'll make it."
Robin did not answer.
She knew it was all her fault, not his. He had offered her the day off. It was she who had been insistent on coming with him to Devon, she who had lied to Matthew about the availability of train seats today. She ought to have stood all the way from London to Harrogate rather than miss Mrs. Cunliffe's funeral. Strike had been with Charlotte 16 years, on and off, and the job had broken them. She did not want to lose Matthew. Why had she done this? Why had she offered to drive Strike? The traffic was dense and slow. By 5 o'clock they were travelling in thick rush-hour traffic outside Reading and crawled to a halt again. Strike turned up the news when it came on the radio. Robin tried to care what they would say about Quine's murder, but her heart was in Yorkshire now, as though it had leapfrogged the traffic and all the implacable snowy miles between her and home. The police have confirmed today that murdered author Owen Quine, whose body was discovered 6 days ago in a house in Barons Court, London, was murdered in the same way as the hero of his last unpublished book. No arrest has yet been made in the case. Detective Inspector Richard Anstis, who is in charge of the investigation, spoke to reporters earlier this afternoon. Anstis, Strike noted, sounded stilted and tense. This was not the way he would have chosen to release the information.
"We're interested in hearing from everyone who had access to the manuscript of Mr. Quine's last novel.
Can you tell us exactly how Mr. Quine was killed, Detective Inspector?"
asked an eager male voice.
"We're waiting for a full forensic report," said Anstis, and he was cut across by a female reporter.
"Can you confirm that parts of Mr. Quine's body were removed by the killer?"
"Part of Mr. Quine's intestines were taken away from the scene," said Anstis. "We're pursuing several leads, but we would appeal to the public for any information. This was an appalling crime, and we believe the perpetrator to be extremely dangerous."
"Not again," said Robin desperately, and Strike looked up to see a wall of red lights ahead. "Not another accident." Strike slapped off the radio, unwound his window, and stuck his head out into the whirling snow.
"No," he shouted to her. "Someone's stuck at the side of the road, in a drift. We'll be moving again in a minute," he reassured her.
But it took another 40 minutes for them to clear the obstruction. All 3 lanes were packed, and they resumed their journey at little more than a crawl.
"I'm not going to make it," said Robin, her mouth dry, as they finally reached the edge of London. It was 10:20.
"You are," said Strike. "Turn that bloody thing off," he said, thumping the sat-nav into silence, "and don't take that exit."
"But I got to drop you. Forget me. You don't need to drop me. Next left.
I can't go down there. It's one way."
"Left," he bellowed, tugging the wheel.
"Don't do that. It's dangerous. Do you want to miss this bloody funeral? Put your foot down, first right."
"Where are we?"
"I know what I'm doing," said Strike, squinting through the snow. "Straight on. My mate Nick's dad's a cabbie. He taught me some stuff. Right again. Ignore the bloody no entry sign. Who's coming out of there on a night like this? Straight on and left at the lights."
"I can't just leave you at King's Cross," she said,
obeying his instructions blindly.
"You can't drive it. What are you going to do with it?"
"Start the car, I'll think of something. Up here. Take the second right." At 5 to 11, the towers of St. Pancras appeared to Robin like a vision of heaven through the snow.
"Pull over, get out and run," said Strike. "Call me if you make it. I'll be here if you don't."
"Thank you."
And she had gone, sprinting over the snow with her weekend bag dangling from her hand. Strike watched her vanish into the darkness, imagined her skidding a little on the slippery floor of the station, not falling, looking wildly around for the platform. She had left the car, on his instructions, at the curb on a double line. If she made the train, he was stranded in a hire car he couldn't drive, and which would certainly be towed. The golden hands on the St. Pancras clock moved inexorably towards 11 o'clock. Strike saw the train door slamming shut in his mind's eye, Robin sprinting up the platform, red-gold hair flying. 1 minute passed. He fixed his eyes on the station entrance and waited. She did not reappear. Still he waited. 5 minutes passed. 6 minutes passed. His mobile rang.
"Did you make it?"
"By the skin of me teeth. It was just about to leave. Cormoran, thank you so much."
"No problem," he said, looking around at the dark icy ground, the deepening snow. "Have a good journey. I better sort myself out. Good luck for tomorrow."
"Thank you,"
she called as he hung up. He had owed her, Strike thought, reaching for his crutches. But that did not make the prospect of a journey across snowy London on one leg, or a hefty fine for abandoning a hire car in the middle of town, much more appealing. Chapter 31. Danger, the spur of all great minds. George Chapman, The Revenge of Bussy d'Amboise. Daniel Chard would not have liked the tiny rented attic flat in Denmark Street, Strike thought, unless he could have found primitive charm in the lines of the old toaster or desk lamp, but there was much to say for it if you happened to be a man with one leg. His knee was still not ready to accept a prosthesis on Saturday morning, but surfaces were within grabbing reach. Distances could be covered in short hops. There was food in the fridge, hot water, and cigarettes. Strike felt a genuine fondness for the place today, with the windows steamy with condensation and blurry snow visible on the sill beyond. After breakfast he lay on his bed, smoking, a mug of dark brown tea beside him on the box that served as a bedside table, glowering not with bad temper, but concentration. 6 days, and nothing. No sign of the intestines that had vanished from Quine's body, nor of any forensic evidence that would have pegged the potential killer, for he knew that a rogue hair or print would surely have prevented yesterday's fruitless interrogation of Leonora. No appeals for further sightings of the concealed figure who had entered the building shortly before Quine had died. Did the police think it a figment of the thick-lensed neighbour's imagination? No murder weapon, no incriminating footage of unexpected visitors to Talgarth Road, no suspicious ramblers noticing freshly turned earth, no mound of rotting guts revealed, wrapped in a black burqa, no sign of Quine's holdall containing his notes for Bombix Mori. Nothing.
6 days.
He had caught killers in 6 hours, though admittedly those had been slapdash crimes of rage and desperation, where fountains of clues had gushed with the blood and the panicking, or incompetent culprits had splattered everyone in their vicinity with their lies. Quine's killing was different, stranger, and more sinister. As Strike raised his mug to his lips, he saw the body again as clearly as though he had viewed the photograph on his mobile. It was a theatre piece. A stage set. In spite of his strictures to Robin, Strike could not help asking himself, why had it been done? Revenge? Madness? Concealment? Of what? Forensic evidence obliterated by the hydrochloric acid, time of death obscured,
Entrance and departure of the crime scene achieved without detection. Planned meticulously, every detail thought out. 6 days and not a single lead. Strike did not believe Anstis's claim to have several. Of course, his old friend was no longer sharing information, not after the tense warnings to Strike to butt out, to keep away. Strike brushed ash absently off the front of his old sweater and lit a fresh cigarette from the stub of the old one. "We believe the perpetrator to be extremely dangerous," Anstis had said to the reporters, a statement in Strike's view that was both painfully obvious and strangely misleading. And a memory came to him. The memory of the great adventure of Dave Polworth's 18th birthday. Polworth was Strike's very oldest friend. They had known each other since nursery. Through childhood and adolescence, Strike had moved away from Cornwall regularly and then returned, the friendship picking up again wherever Strike's mother and her whims had last interrupted it. Dave had an uncle who had left for Australia in his teens and was now a multimillionaire. He had invited his nephew to come and stay for his 18th birthday, and to bring a mate. Across the world the two teenagers had flown. It had been the best adventure of their young lives. They had stayed in Uncle Kevin's massive beachside house, all glass and shining wood, with a bar in the sitting room. Diamond sea spray in a blinding sun, and enormous pink prawns on a barbecue skewer. The accents, the beer, more beer, the sort of butterscotch limb blondes you never saw in Cornwall, and then, on Dave's actual birthday, the shark.
"They're only dangerous if they're provoked," said Uncle Kevin, who liked his scuba diving. "No touching, lads, all right? No arsing around." But for Dave Polworth, who loved the sea, who surfed, fished and sailed at home, arsing around was a way of life. A killer born, with its flat dead eyes and its ranks of stiletto teeth. But Strike had witnessed the black tip's lazy indifference as they swam over it, awed by its sleek beauty. It would have been content to glide away through the azure gloom, he knew that, but Dave was determined to touch. He had the scar still. The shark had torn away a tidy chunk of his forearm, and he had only partial feeling in his right thumb. It had not affected his ability to do his job. Dave was a civil engineer in Bristol now, and they called him Chum in the Victory Inn where he and Strike still met to drink Doombar on their visits home. Stubborn, reckless, a thrill-seeker to his core, Polworth still scuba-dived in his free time, though he left the basking sharks of the Atlantic well alone. There was a fine crack on the ceiling over Strike's bed. He did not think he had ever noticed it before. His eyes followed it as he remembered the shadow on a seabed and a sudden cloud of black blood, the thrashing of Dave's body in a silent scream. The killer of Owen Quine was like that black tip, he thought. There were no frenzied, indiscriminate predators among the suspects in this case. None of them had a known history of violence. There was not, as so often when bodies turned up, a trail of past misdemeanors leading to the door of a suspect. No blood-stained past dragging behind any of them like a bag of offal for hungry hounds. This killer was a rarer, stranger beast. The one who concealed their true nature until sufficiently disturbed. Owen Quine, like Dave Polworth, had recklessly taunted a murderer-in-waiting and unleashed horror upon himself. Strike had heard the glib assertion many times that everyone had it in them to kill, but he knew this to be a lie. There were undoubtedly those to whom killing was easy and pleasurable. He had met a few such. Millions had been successfully trained to end others' lives. He, Strike, was one of them. Humans killed opportunistically for advantage and in defense, discovering in themselves the capacity for bloodshed when no alternative seemed possible. But there were also people who were drawn up short, even under the most intense pressure, unable to press their advantage, to seize the opportunity, to break the final,
and greatest taboo. Strike did not underestimate what it had taken to bind, batter, and slice open Owen Quine. The person who had done it had achieved their goal without detection, successfully disposed of the evidence, and appeared not to be exhibiting sufficient distress or guilt to alert anyone. All of this argued a dangerous personality, a highly dangerous personality, if disturbed. While they believed themselves to be undetected and unsuspected, there was no danger to anybody around them. But if touched again, touched perhaps in the place where Owen Quine had managed to touch them. "Fuck," murmured Strike, dropping his cigarette hastily into the ashtray beside him. It had burned down to his fingers without him noticing. So what was he to do next? If the trail away from the crime was practically non-existent, Strike thought, he must pursue the trail towards the crime. If the aftermath of Quine's death was unnaturally devoid of clues, it was time to look at his last few days of life. Strike picked up his mobile and sighed deeply, looking at it. Was there, he asked himself, any other way of getting at the first piece of information he sought? He ran through his extensive list of acquaintances in his head, discarding options as quickly as they occurred. Finally, and without much enthusiasm, he concluded that his original choice was most likely to bring in the goods, his half-brother Alexander. They shared a famous father, but had never lived under the same roof. Al was 9 years younger than Strike, and was Johnny Rokeby's legitimate son, which meant that there was virtually no point of coincidence in their lives. Al had been privately educated in Switzerland, and he might be anywhere right now. In Rokeby's L.A. residence, on a rapper's yacht, even a white Australian beach, for Rokeby's third wife was from Sydney. And yet of his half-siblings on his father's side, Al had shown himself more willing than any of the others to forge a relationship with his older brother. Strike remembered Al visiting him in hospital after his leg had been blown off, an awkward encounter, but touching in retrospect. Al had brought with him to Selly Oak an offer from Rokeby that could have been made by mail, financial help in starting Strike's detective business. Al had announced the offer with pride, considering it evidence of his father's altruism. Strike had been sure that it was no such thing. He suspected that Rokeby or his advisers had been nervous about the one-legged, decorated veteran selling his story. The offer of a gift was supposed to stop his mouth. Strike had turned down his father's largesse, and then been refused by every single bank to which he applied for a loan. He had called Al back with immense reluctance, refusing to take the money as a gift, turning down a proffered meeting with his father, but asking whether he could have a loan. This had evidently caused offence. Rokeby's lawyer had subsequently pursued Strike for his monthly payments with all the zeal of the most rapacious bank. Had Strike not chosen to keep Robin on his payroll, the loan would have already been cleared. He was determined to repay it before Christmas, determined not to be beholden to Johnny Rokeby, which was why he had taken on a workload that had lately seen him working 8 or 9 hours, 7 days a week. None of this made the prospect of calling his younger brother for a favour any more comfortable. Strike could understand Al's loyalty to a father whom he clearly loved, but any mention between them of Rokeby was necessarily charged. Al's number rang several times, and finally went to voicemail. As relieved as he was disappointed, Strike left a brief message asking Al to call him and hung up. Lighting his third cigarette since breakfast, Strike reverted to his contemplation of the crack in the ceiling. The trail towards the crime. So much depended on when the killer had seen the manuscript, had recognized its potential as a blueprint for murder. And, once again, he flicked through the suspects as though they were a hand of cards he had been dealt, examining their potentialities. Elizabeth Tassel, who made no secret of the rage and pain Bombix Mori had caused her, Catherine Kent, who claimed not to have read it at all. The still unknown Pippa 2011, to whom Quine had read parts of the book back in October. Jerry Waldegrave, who had had the manuscript on the 5th, but might, if Chard was to be believed, have known what was in there way before. Daniel Chard, who claimed that he had not seen it until the 7th. And Michael Fancourt, who had heard about the book from Chard. Yes, there were sundry others, peeking and peering and giggling at the most salacious parts of the book, emailed all over London by Christian Fisher. But Strike found it very hard to work up even the vaguest of cases against Fisher, young Ralph in Tassel's office, or Nina Lascelles, none of whom were featured in Bombyx Mori, nor had really known Quine. He needed, Strike thought, to get closer. Close enough to ruffle the people whose lives had already been mocked and distorted by Owen Quine. With only a little more enthusiasm than he had brought to the task of calling Al, he scrolled through his contact list and called Nina Lascelles. It was a brief call. She was delighted. Of course he could come over tonight. She'd cook. Strike could think of no other way to probe for further details of Jerry Waldegrave's private life, or for Michael Fancourt's reputation as a literary assassin. But he did not look forward to the painful process of reattaching his prosthesis, not to mention the effort it would require to detach himself again, tomorrow morning, from Nina Lascelles' hopeful clutches. However, he had Arsenal versus Aston Villa to watch before he needed to leave. Painkillers, cigarettes, bacon and bread. Preoccupied with his own comfort, a mixture of football and murder on his mind, it did not occur to Strike to glance down into the snowy street where shoppers, undeterred by the freezing weather, were gliding in and out of the music stores, the instrument makers and the cafes. Had he done so, he might have seen the willowy hooded figure in the black coat leaning against the wall between number 6 and 8, staring up at his flat. Good as his eyesight was, however, he would have been unlikely to spot the Stanley knife being turned rhythmically between long, fine fingers. Chapter 32. Rise, my good angel, whose holy tunes beat from me that evil spirit which jogs mine elbow. Thomas Dekker, the noble Spanish soldier. Even with snow chains on its tyres, the old family Land Rover driven by Robin's mother had had a hard job of it between York Station and Massam. The wipers made fan-shaped windows, swiftly obliterated, onto roads familiar to Robin since childhood, now transformed by the worst winter she had seen in many years. The snow was relentless and the journey, which should have taken an hour, lasted nearly 3. There had been moments when Robin had thought she might yet miss the funeral. At least she had been able to speak to Matthew on her mobile, explaining that she was close. He had told her that several others were still miles away, that he was afraid his aunt from Cambridge might not make it at all. At home, Robin had dodged the slobbering welcome of their old chocolate Labrador and hurtled upstairs to her room, pulling on the black dress and coat without bothering to iron them, laddering her first pair of tights in her haste, then running back downstairs to the hall where her parents and brothers were waiting for her. They walked together through the swirling snow beneath black umbrellas, up the gentle hill Robin had climbed every day of her primary school years, and across the wide square that was the ancient heart of her tiny hometown, their backs to the giant chimney of the local brewery. The Saturday market had been cancelled. Deep channels had been made in the snow by those few brave souls who had crossed the square that morning, footprints converging near the church, where Robin could see a crowd of black-coated mourners. The roofs of the pale gold Georgian houses lining the square wore mantles of bright, frozen icing, and still the snow kept coming. A rising sea of white was steadily burying the large square tombstones in the cemetery.
Robin shivered as the family edged towards the doors of St. Mary the Virgin, past the remnant of a 9th-century round-shafted cross that had a curiously pagan appearance. And then, at last, she saw Matthew standing in the porch with his father and sister, pale and heart-stoppingly handsome in his black suit. As Robin watched, trying to catch his eye over the queue, a young woman reached up and embraced him. Robin recognized Sarah Shadlock, Matthew's old friend from university. Her greeting was a little more lascivious, perhaps, than was appropriate in the circumstances. But Robin's guilt about having come within 10 seconds of missing the overnight train, about not having seen Matthew in nearly a week, made her feel she had no right to resent it. "Robin," he said urgently when he saw her, and he forgot to shake three people's hands as he held out his arms to her. As they hugged, she felt tears prickle beneath her eyelids. This was real life after all, Matthew, and home. "Go and sit at the front," he told her, and she obeyed, leaving her family at the back of the church to sit in the front pew with Matthew's brother-in-law, who was dandling his baby daughter on his knee and greeted Robin with a morose nod. It was a beautiful old church, and Robin knew it well from the Christmas, Easter, and harvest services she had attended all her life with her primary school and family. Her eyes travelled slowly from familiar object to familiar object. High above her, over the chancel arch, was a painting by Sir Joshua Reynolds, or at least the school of Joshua Reynolds, and she fixed upon it, trying to compose her mind. A misty, mystical image, the boy angel contemplating the distant vision of a cross emitting golden rays. Who had really done it, she wondered, Reynolds or some studio acolyte? And then she felt guilty that she was indulging her perennial curiosity instead of feeling sad about Mrs. Cunliffe. She had thought that she would be marrying here in a few weeks' time. Her wedding dress was hanging ready in the spare room's wardrobe, but instead, here was Mrs. Cunliffe's coffin coming up the aisle, shining black, with silver handles. Owen Quine still in the morgue. No shiny coffin for his disemboweled body yet, rotted and burned. "Don't think about that," she told herself sternly as Matthew sat down beside her, the length of his leg warm against hers. The last 24 hours had been so packed with incident that it was hard for Robin to believe she was here, at home. She and Strike might have been in hospital. They had come close to slamming headfirst into that overturned lorry, the driver covered in blood. Mrs. Cunliffe was probably unscathed in her silk-lined box. "Don't think about that." It was as though her eyes were being stripped of a comfortable soft focus. Maybe seeing things like bound and disemboweled bodies did something to you, changed the way you saw the world. She knelt a little late for prayer, the cross-stitched hassock rough beneath her freezing knees. Poor Mrs. Cunliffe. Except that Matthew's mother had never much liked her. "Be kind," Robin implored herself, even though it was true. Mrs. Cunliffe had not liked the idea of Matthew being tied to the same girlfriend for so long. She had mentioned, within Robin's hearing, how good it was for young men to play the field, sow their wild oats. The way in which Robin had left university had tainted her, she knew, in Mrs. Cunliffe's eyes. The statue of Sir Marmaduke Wyville was facing Robin from mere feet away. As she stood for the hymn, he seemed to be staring at her in his Jacobean dress, life-sized and horizontal on his marble shelf, propped up on his elbow to face the congregation. His wife lay beneath him in an identical pose. They were oddly real in their irreverent poses, cushions beneath their elbows to keep their marble bones comfortable, and above them, in the spandrels, allegorical figures of death and mortality. "Till death us do part." And her thoughts drifted again. She and Matthew, tied together forever until they died. No, not tied.
Don't think tired. What's wrong with you?
She was exhausted. The train had been overheated and jerky. She had woken on the hour, afraid that it would get stuck in the snow. Matthew reached for her hand and squeezed her fingers. The burial took place as quickly as decency allowed, the snow falling thick around them. There was no lingering at the graveside. Robin was not the only one perceptibly shivering. Everyone went back to the Cunliffe's big brick house and milled around in the welcome warmth. Mr. Cunliffe, who was always a little louder than the occasion warranted, kept filling glasses and greeting people as though it were a party.
"I've missed you," Matthew said. "It's been horrible without you."
"Me too," said Robin. "I wish I could have been here."
"Lying again?"
"Auntie Sue's staying tonight," said Matthew. "I thought I could maybe come over to your place. Be good to get away for a bit. It's been full on this week."
"Great, yes,"
said Robin, squeezing his hand, grateful that she would not have to stay at the Cunliffe's. She found Matthew's sister hard work and Mr. Cunliffe overbearing.
"But you could have put up with it for a night," she told herself sternly.
It felt like an undeserved escape. And so they returned to the Ellicott's house, a short walk from the square. Matthew liked her family. He was glad to change out of his suit into jeans to help her mother lay the kitchen table for dinner. Mrs. Ellicott, an ample woman with Robin's red-gold hair tucked up in an untidy bun, treated him with gentle kindness. She was a woman of many interests and enthusiasms, currently doing an open university degree in English literature. "How are the studies going, Linda?" Matthew asked, as he lifted the heavy casserole dish out of the oven for her. "We're doing Webster, the Duchess of Malfi, and I'm grown mad with't." "Difficult, is it?" asked Matthew.
"That's a quotation, love."
"Oh." She dropped the serving spoons onto the side with a clatter. "That reminds me. I bet I've missed it." She crossed the kitchen and snatched up a copy of the Radio Times, always present in their house. "No, it's on at 9. There's an interview with Michael Fancourt I want to watch."
"Michael Fancourt?" said Robin, looking round. "Why?"
"He's very influenced by all those revenge tragedians," said her mother. "I'm hoping he'll explain the appeal."
"Seen this?" said Robin's youngest brother, Jonathan, fresh back from the corner shop with the extra milk requested by his mother. "It's on the front page, Rob. That writer with his guts ripped out."
"John!"
said Mrs. Ellicott sharply. Robin knew that her mother was not reprimanding her son out of any suspicion that Matthew would not appreciate mention of her job, but because of a more general aversion to discussing sudden death in the aftermath of the burial.
"What?"
said Jonathan, oblivious to the proprieties, shoving the Daily Express under Robin's nose. Quine had made the front page now that the press knew what had been done to him. "Horror author wrote own murder." "Horror author," Robin thought. He was hardly that. But it makes a good headline. "Is your boss going to solve it, do you reckon?" Jonathan asked her, thumbing through the paper. "Show up the Met again?" She began to read the account over Jonathan's shoulder, but caught Matthew's eye and moved away. A buzzing issued from Robin's handbag, discarded in a sagging chair in the corner of the flagged kitchen as they ate their meal of stew and baked potatoes. She ignored it. Only when they had finished eating and Matthew was dutifully helping her mother clear the table did Robin wander to her bag to check her messages. To her great surprise, she saw a missed call from Strike. With a surreptitious glance at Matthew, who was busily stacking plates in the dishwasher, she called voicemail while the others chatted. "You have one new message, received today at 7:20 p.m. The crackle of an open line, but no speech. Then a thud, a yell in the distance from Strike.
"No, you don't, you fucking—"
A bellow of pain. Silence.
the crackle of the open line. Indeterminate crunching, dragging sounds, loud panting, a scraping noise, the line dead. Robin stood aghast, the phone pressed against her ear.
"What's the matter?"
asked her father, glasses halfway down his nose as he paused on the way to the dresser, knives and forks in his hand.
I think my boss has had an accident.
She pressed Strike's number with shaking fingers. The call went straight to voicemail. Matthew was standing in the middle of the kitchen watching her, his displeasure undisguised. Chapter 33. Hard fate when women are compelled to woo. Thomas Decker and Thomas Middleton, the honest whore. Strike did not hear Robin calling because, unbeknownst to him, his mobile had been knocked onto silent when it had hit the ground 15 minutes previously. Nor was he aware that his thumb had hit Robin's number as the phone slipped through his fingers. He had only just left his building when it happened. The door onto the street had swung shut behind him, and he had had 2 seconds, with his mobile in his hand, waiting for a ring back from the cab he had reluctantly ordered, when the tall figure in the black coat had come running at him through the darkness. A blur of pale skin beneath a hood and a scarf, her arm outstretched, inexpert but determined, with the knife pointing directly at him in a wavering clutch. Bracing himself to meet her, he had almost slipped again, but, slamming his hand to the door, he steadied himself and the mobile fell. Shocked and furious with her, whoever she was, for the damage her pursuit had already done to his knee, he bellowed. She checked for a split second, then came at him once more. As he swung his stick at the hand in which he had already seen the Stanley knife, his knee twisted again. He let out a roar of pain and she leapt back, as though she had stabbed him without knowing it, and then, for the second time, she had panicked and taken flight, sprinting away through the snow, leaving a furious and frustrated Strike unable to give chase, and with no choice but to scrabble around in the snow for his phone.
Fuck this leg.
When Robin called him, he was sitting in a crawling taxi, sweating with pain. It was small consolation that the tiny triangular blade he had seen glinting in his pursuer's hand had not pierced him. His knee, to which he had felt obliged to fit the prosthesis before setting out for Nina's, was excruciating once more, and he was burning with rage at his inability to give chase to his mad stalker. He had never hit a woman, never knowingly hurt one, but the sight of the knife coming at him through the dark had rendered such scruples void. To the consternation of the taxi driver, who was watching his large, furious-looking passenger in the rear-view mirror, Strike kept twisting in his seat in case he saw her walking along the busy Saturday night pavements, round-shouldered in her black coat, her knife concealed in her pocket. The cab was gliding beneath the Christmas lights of Oxford Street, large, fragile parcels of silver wrapped with golden bows, and Strike fought his ruffled temper as they travelled, feeling no pleasure at the thought of his imminent dinner date. Again and again Robin called him, but he could not feel the mobile vibrating because it was deep in his coat pocket, which lay beside him on the seat. "Hi," said Nina with a forced smile when she opened the door to her flat half an hour after the agreed time.
"Sorry I'm late," said Strike, limping over the threshold. "I had an accident leaving the house. My leg."
He had not brought her anything, he realized, standing there in his overcoat. He should have brought wine or chocolates, and he felt her notice it as her big eyes roved over him. She had good manners herself, and he felt suddenly a little shabby.
"And I've forgotten the wine I bought you," he lied. "This is crap. Chuck me out."
As she laughed, though unwillingly, Strike felt the phone vibrate in his pocket and automatically pulled it out. Robin. He could not think why she wanted him on a Saturday.
"Sorry," he told Nina.
Gotta take this urgent, it's my assistant.
Her smile slipped. She turned and walked out of the hall, leaving him there in his coat.
Robin?
Are you all right? What happened?
How did you...
I've got a voicemail that sounds like a recording of you being attacked.
Christ, did I call you? Must have been when I dropped the phone.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
5 minutes later, having told Robin what had happened, he hung up his coat and followed his nose to the sitting room, where Nina had laid a table for two. The room was lamplit. She had tidied, put fresh flowers around the place. A strong smell of burnt garlic hung in the air.
Sorry, he repeated as she returned, carrying a dish. Wish I had a 9-to-5 job sometimes.
Help yourself to wine,
she said coolly. The situation was deeply familiar. How often had he sat opposite a woman who was irritated by his lateness, his divided attention, his casualness? But here at least, it was being played out in a minor key. If he had been late for dinner with Charlotte and taken a call from another woman as soon as he had arrived, he might have expected a full face of wine and flying crockery. That thought made him feel more kindly towards Nina.
Detectives make shit dates, he told her as he sat down.
I wouldn't say shit, she replied, softening. I don't suppose it's the sort of job you can leave behind. She was watching him with her huge, mouse-like eyes.
I had a nightmare about you last night, she said.
Getting off to a flying start, aren't we? Said Strike.
And she laughed.
Well, not really about you. We were together looking for Owen Quine's intestinal tract.
She took a big swig of wine, gazing at him.
Did we find it? Strike asked, trying to keep things light.
Yes.
Where? I'll take any leads at this point.
In Jerry Waldegrave's bottom desk drawer, said Nina. And he thought he saw her repress a shudder.
It was horrible, actually. Blood and guts when I opened it. And you hit Jerry. It woke me up, it was so real.
She drank more wine, not touching her food. Strike, who had already taken several hearty mouthfuls, far too much garlic, but he was hungry, felt he was being insufficiently sympathetic. He swallowed hastily and said,
"Sounds creepy."
"It's because of what was on the news yesterday," she said, watching him. "Nobody realized, nobody knew he'd been killed like that. Like Bombix Mori. You didn't tell me," she said, and a whiff of accusation reached him through the garlic fumes.
"I couldn't," said Strike. "It's up to the police to release that kind of information."
"It's on the front page of the Daily Express today. He'd have liked that, Owen, being a headline. But I wish I hadn't read it," she said, with a furtive look at him.
He had met these qualms before. Some people recoiled once they realized what he had seen, or done, or touched. It was as though he carried the smell of death on him. There were always women who were attracted by the soldier, the policeman. They experienced a vicarious thrill, a voluptuous appreciation at the violence a man might have seen or perpetrated. Other women were repelled. Nina, he suspected, had been one of the former, but now that the reality of cruelty, sadism, and sickness had been forced on her, she was discovering that she might, after all, belong in the second camp.
"It wasn't fun at work yesterday," she said. "Not after we'd heard that. Everyone was... It's just, if he was killed that way, if the killer copied the book, it limits the possible suspects, doesn't it? Nobody's laughing about Bombix Mori anymore, I can tell you that. It's like one of Michael Fancourt's old plots, back when the critics said he was too grisly. And Jerry's resigned."
"I heard."
"I don't know why," she said restlessly. "He's been at Roper Chart ages. He's not being himself at all, angry all the time, and he's usually so lovely. And he's drinking again. A lot."
She was still not eating.
"Was he close to Quine?" Strike asked.
"I think he was closer than he thought he was.
said Nina slowly. They'd worked together quite a long time. Owen drove him mad. Owen drove everyone mad. But Jerry's really upset, I can tell.
I can't imagine Quine enjoying being edited.
I think he was tricky sometimes, said Nina. But Jerry won't hear a word against Owen now. He's obsessed by his breakdown theory. You heard him at the party. He thinks Owen was mentally ill and Bombix Mori wasn't really his fault. And he's still raging against Elizabeth Tassel for letting the book out. She came in the other day to talk about one of her other authors.
Dorcas Pengelly? Strike asked. And Nina gave a little gasp of laughter.
You don't read that crap. Heaving bosoms and shipwrecks.
The name stuck in my mind, said Strike, grinning. Go on about Waldegrave.
He saw Liz coming and slammed his office door as she walked past. You've seen it, it's glass, and he nearly broke it. Really unnecessary and obvious. It made everyone jump out of their skins.
She looks ghastly, added Nina. Liz Tassel, awful. If she'd been on form, she'd have stormed into Jerry's office and told him not to be so bloody rude.
Would she?
Are you crazy? Liz Tassel's temper is legendary.
Nina glanced at her watch. Michael Fancourt's being interviewed on the telly this evening. I'm recording it, she said, refilling both their glasses. She still had not touched her food.
Wouldn't mind watching that, said Strike.
She threw him an oddly calculating look, and Strike guessed that she was trying to assess how much his presence was due to a desire to pick her brains, how much designs on her slim, boyish body. His mobile rang again. For several seconds he weighed the offence he might cause if he answered it, versus the possibility that it might herald something more useful than Nina's opinions about Jerry Waldegrave.
Sorry, he said, and pulled it out of his pocket. It was his brother, Al.
Coram, said the voice over a noisy line. Great to hear from you, bruv.
Hi, said Strike repressively.
How are you?
Great. I'm in New York. Only just got your message. What do you need?
He knew that Strike would only call if he wanted something, but unlike Nina, Al did not seem to resent the fact.
Wondering if you fancied dinner this Friday, said Strike. But if you're in New York...
I'm coming back Wednesday. That'd be cool. Want me to book somewhere?
Yeah, said Strike. It's gotta be the River Cafe.
I'll get on it, said Al, without asking why.
Perhaps he assumed that Strike merely had a yen for good Italian.
Text you the time, yeah? Look forward to it.
Strike hung up, the first syllable of an apology already on his lips. But Nina had left for the kitchen. The atmosphere had undoubtedly curdled. Chapter 34 O Lord, what have I said? My unlucky tongue. William Congreve, Love for Love.
Love is a mirage, said Michael Fancourt on the television screen. A mirage, a chimera, a delusion.
Robin was sitting between Matthew and her mother on the faded, sagging sofa. The chocolate Labrador lay on the floor in front of the fire, his tail thumping lazily on the rug in his sleep. Robin felt drowsy after two nights of very little sleep and days of unexpected stresses and emotion, but she was trying hard to concentrate on Michael Fancourt. Beside her, Mrs. Ellicott, who had expressed the optimistic hope that Fancourt might let drop some bon mots that would help with her essay on Webster, had a notebook and pen on her lap.
Surely,
began the interviewer, but Fancourt talked over him.
We don't love each other. We love the idea we have of each other. Very few humans understand this or can bear to contemplate it. They have blind faith in their own powers of creation. All love, ultimately, is self-love.
Mr. Ellicott was asleep, his head back in the armchair closest to the fire and the dog. Gently he snored, with his spectacles halfway down his nose. All three of Robin's brothers had slid discreetly from the house. It was Saturday night, and their mates were waiting in the bay horse on the square. John had come home from university for the funeral, but did not feel he owed it to his sister's fiancé to forego a few pints of black sheep with his brothers, sitting in the dimpled copper tables by the open fire. Robin suspected that Matthew had wanted to join them, but that he had felt it would be unseemly. Now he was stuck watching a literary program he would never have tolerated at home. He would have turned over without asking her, taking it for granted that she could not possibly be interested in what this sour-looking, sententious man was saying. It was not easy to like Michael Fancourt, thought Robin. The curve of both his lip and his eyebrows implied an ingrained sense of superiority. The presenter, who was well known, seemed a little nervous. "And that is the theme of your new..."
"One of the themes, yes. Rather than castigating himself for his foolishness when the hero realizes that he has simply imagined his wife into being, he seeks to punish the flesh-and-blood woman whom he believes has duped him. His desire for revenge drives the plot."
"Aha," said Robin's mother softly, picking up her pen. "Many of us, most, perhaps," said the interviewer, "consider love a purifying ideal, a source of selflessness rather than a self-justifying lie," said Fancourt. "We are mammals who need sex, need companionship, who seek the protective enclave of the family for reasons of survival and reproduction. We select a so-called loved one for the most primitive reasons. My hero's preference for a pear-shaped woman is self-explanatory, I think. The loved one laughs or smells like the parent who gave one youthful sucker, and all else is projected. All else is invented."
"Friendship," began the interviewer a little desperately.
"If I could have brought myself to have sex with any of my male friends, I would have had a happier and more productive life," said Fancourt. "Unfortunately, I'm programmed to desire the female form, however fruitlessly. And so I tell myself that one woman is more fascinating, more attuned to my needs and desires, than another. I am a complex, highly evolved, and imaginative creature who feels compelled to justify a choice made on the crudest grounds. This is the truth that we've buried under 1,000 years of courtly bullshit."
Robin wondered what on earth Fancourt's wife, for she seemed to remember that he was married, would make of this interview. Beside her, Mrs. Ellicott had written a few words on her notepad.
"He's not talking about revenge," Robin muttered.
Her mother showed her the notepad. She had written, "What a shit he is." Robin giggled. Beside her, Matthew leaned over to the Daily Express that Jonathan had left abandoned on a chair. He turned past the front three pages, where Strike's name appeared several times in the text alongside Owen Quine's, and began to read a piece on how a high street chain of stores had banned Cliff Richard's Christmas songs. "You've been criticized," said the interviewer bravely, "for your depiction of women, most particularly..."
"I can hear the critics cockroach-like scurrying for their pens as we speak," said Fancourt, his lip curling in what passed for a smile. "I can think of little that interests me less than what critics say about me or my work."
Matthew turned a page of the paper. Robin glanced sideways at a picture of an overturned tanker, an upside-down Honda Civic, and a mangled Mercedes. "That's the crash we were nearly in."
"What?" said Matthew.
She had said it without thinking. Robin's brain froze.
"That happened on the M4,
Matthew said, half laughing at her for thinking she could have been involved, that she could not recognize a motorway when she saw one.
Oh, yes,
said Robin, pretending to peer more closely at the text beneath the picture. But he was frowning now, catching up.
Were you nearly in a car crash yesterday? He was speaking quietly, trying not to disturb Mrs. Ellicott, who was following Fancourt's interview. Hesitation was fatal. Choose.